Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, Always a Bridesmaid, Never a Bride. Matthew 25, verses 1 through 13. Presented by Michael Pallett. Number PO-M-2006-14. Let's listen in.
Welcome to the post-4th of July cool-down, after all the excitement of yesterday. And we're continuing our look at Matthew 24 and 25 in the light of the very end of Matthew's Gospel, what's been called the Great Commission, in which we have the theme verse. Theme for our summer. I am with you always. And so we're looking at Matthew 24, 25 that talks about the end of the world, if you will, in the context of that last section of Matthew's gospel. What does it mean to talk about end of the world? What does that mean for us when the last and lasting word we have is Jesus' assurance, I am with you always until the end or the consummation of the age. And so we're trying to work our way through that and see how we understand some of these end of the world texts. And the last part of Matthew 24 and then working our way into 25 has some parables to help us understand that. And we began a little bit yesterday, or where we ended up yesterday, was a parable of a faithful slash unfaithful servant. This is chapter 24, verses 45 to 51. And then we'll talk about that a little more, and then we'll move into the next parable, which is the parable of the foolish and wise bridesmaids. And when we look at these two parables, we have to kind of read them together because they're meant to complement one another. And the complement that is there is that in that first parable of the faithful, unfaithful servant, it looks at the issue of what happens if Jesus comes sooner than is expected. And the parable of the bridesmaids is what happens if Jesus comes later than expected. And so you can see that sooner than, later than, tension is there. And the parables help us address that in terms, again, of how is one, as we ended up yesterday, going to be one of the ready ones. Both of these parables then have a sense of judgment about them. And so the question there that I've got on the board that I asked yesterday is, does the absence of judgment make grace unreal? Or another way of putting it is it not judgment which makes grace really grace? And so I know you've been thinking about that for the last 24 hours, so we'll address that question as we come a little more to the end of our session today. But first, to look at some of these parables more closely. So the first one about the faithful and unfaithful servant or slave, because again, it's talking about kind of one person who is given these two possibilities. And so in verse 45, Jesus asks, who then is the faithful and wise slave whom the master has set over his household to give them their food in season? We see here again that Jesus begins by asking a question. And so by asking a question, it already will ask us as readers or as hearers to make a judgment. Who is faithful? Who is wise? We'll have to make that judgment. What is meant here by faithful, I think, is a term, other kind of synonyms we could use are notions like loyal, or one who is loyal or trustworthy, who is true to what one has been given. Here it's in terms of faithfulness toward, if you will, the feeding of the household, tending those in the household whom the master has left. The word for wise is a word that I think can be translated as something like practically prudent. In Greek, again, there are two words for wise, or that can be translated wise. One is sophos, that's the one we usually know, wisdom. Like in philosophy, the lover of wisdom. And that kind of wisdom, that kind of wise, is in the power of reasoning that has to do with the high levels of reasoning or thinking. So that this kind of sophos might have within it something like logic or whatever. Phronesis is also a kind of wisdom, but it is in the realm of practical wisdom or practical reasoning. It talks about a person who has a lot of experience and therefore knows the kind of appropriate action with regard to a situation. So that, for example, we'll use a cooking situation. You're cooking away and whatever you're doing, you burn it. And you go, uh-oh, now what do I do? Right? The wise cook has a practical reason, has the experience to say, oh, I burn food lots of times, you know? I know what to do when you burn food. That's you throw it away and you call and order in pizza. Oh, no, that's not I do, right? But there's an appropriate way that you can even handle burnt food such that it can be treated, right? That's exercising phronesis. And so here, the kind of thing again is, how are we as followers of Jesus to live knowing that Jesus is with us always, and yet the end as well is coming? And it is unexpected, as we said, it is imminent and incalculable. How does one live in a world where things are imminent and incalculable? Or again, how do you live in the world of contingency? Because you don't want to be caught with Jesus coming sooner than you expected, nor do you want to be befuddled because Jesus is coming later than you expected. So that calls for phronesis, the kind of experienced one of faith who knows what the appropriate action is. That's what makes you wise. And so again, both with this faithful and wise servant or this unfaithful and foolish servant, or as we have the wise and the foolish bridesmaids. That's what we mean here by wise, the one who knows how to act appropriately and carry out what the situation calls for. Right? It's So it's, again, a practical way of being alert. And again, I think one of the interesting things here is that the master is put in charge of the household, but it's that to give the other slaves, or to give them, it would simply say, their food in season. NRSV says, food at the proper time. Again, the Greek, giving them their food in season, that notion of giving something their food in season is an allusion to what? Those of you who have the scriptures memorized.
The Psalms,
right? And we sometimes use that as a table prayer. Anyone know what that phrase would be for?
You give them their food in due season, you open your hand and satisfy the desire of
your heart. Right, precisely. It's from Psalm 104, verse 27. Sometimes we ignore, right? The eyes of all wait upon you, O God, and you give them their food in season. You open your hands and satisfy the desire of every living thing. So there's that connection there, you see, that indeed what this slave or servant is to do is indeed do what the master were around, would do. And it's, again, I think interestingly enough, narrowed down to that sense of feeding people in due season. Right. It's centered around the table. So in other words, in Holdenese, this master leaves and gives this slave the command to say, you are now head waitress. And so the question is, what is it to be a faithful and wise head waitress? That's our question. That's what we're going to have to make some judgments about. So, as we think about that and those notions here, we see also that this head waitress is set over the other slaves in the household. And again, set over is a term for leadership and authority. One might say here that perhaps specifically this parable is addressed to leaders within the Christian community. Perhaps one way of thinking about this is this might be Jesus' ordination sermon. And so someone is being ordained and Jesus is asked to be the guest preacher. And he's saying, okay, let's think about this. You're the head waitress. That's your ordination. Again, right? The kind of hyperbole that happens here is that we know, of course, if you're going to be in charge of a household, a slave or that steward would have many other tasks than simply making sure the people are fed. But in this parable, feeding in due season those others in the household seems to be the one and only task. Now, why is feeding important?
If it involves eating the Word of God, it is the highest, most important responsibility.
Okay, so feeding might be eating the Word of God. What else? What might feeding be an image or metaphor about? Any other And yes?
Caring for the needs of the household.
Caring for the needs of the household. Okay, but again, why specifically feeding?
And that would include feeding or...
Okay, so you want to see feeding is a notion there for caring. So we've got feeding is like eating the word. It's metaphor for caring. Can you think of anywhere else in the gospel? Jesus might talk about feeding and what that entails.
The Eucharist?
His body and blood.
Well, it can be the Eucharist.
Feed my sheep, feed my lamb.
Okay. So, and what is Jesus talking about when he says, feed my sheep, feed my lambs?
Nurture.
Nurture? Can we be more specific than nurture?
He's talking to Peter after the resurrection, trying to get him on board, considering that three times he's denied Jesus. So there's some sense of forgiveness and, you know, you're still part of over about or the leader of over about.
Okay, so there's some sense of forgiveness.
Pastoral responsibility.
Their pastoral responsibility, but I want to get more specific. What kind of pastoral responsibility is there in feeding?
Well, feeding is pretty, food is basic to survival.
Yeah.
So it seems like this is just back to the basics. What's the most important thing you have to do?
All right, and that is what, Peggy?
Keep them alive.
To know,
no.
To know a message, to hear the message.
To hear the message,
sure.
Or I think... For Jesus here, the metaphor for feeding is that broad category of teaching, right? Under which, I mean, eating the word, the specific notion of caring for them goes in with teaching. The Eucharist, again, is there, but think about that as a visible word, another way of teaching the gospel. The nurturing and the forgiveness that comes here always comes back to a notion of teaching. How does that know? And again, right, the Great Commission here, again, we have three imperatives, right, or actually four. Go, disciple, baptize, teach. The other thing in Matthew's gospel, specifically with regard to the word teach, throughout Jesus' ministry, there were basically three key functions. Heal, proclaim, teach. Throughout the gospel, Jesus does all three. Heal, proclaim, teach. When he sends the disciples out at the end of chapter 9 and the beginning of chapter 10, the disciples heal and proclaim. They don't teach. They finally are given the commission to teach at the very end of the gospel, here in chapter 28. It's again a sense that until they have undergone and experienced the cross and resurrection, they're not prepared to teach. They can proclaim. They can tell what God has done and is doing, and they can heal, they can exorcise, they can even raise the dead, but they can't teach. That comes at the very end. So teaching is extremely important because that is the basic way of feeding and nourishing the community. One other place that I want to look at for Matthew's, I mean, we could spend a lot of time in that last part of chapter 9, beginning at chapter 9, verse 35, about the sense of teaching and what that's all about, but we won't. How's that? But another one I want to look at, because again, we don't usually quite put it in that context, is Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 to 30. Matthew 11, 28 to 30. And if someone, when you find that, would just read it for us, please.
Come to me, all you who labor and are heavily burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
Okay. That's a favorite passage for a lot of people, right? We all like that passage. Does that passage ever bother you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why does it bother you, Tracy?
Well, that yoke is pretty rough. I mean, if we're going to take Jesus' yoke upon us, look at what happened to him. So he may think it's light and easy because he's there with us, but it still scares the crud out of me, the idea of taking that on.
Yeah. Or, I mean, the whole thing. What's going on here, right? Come to me, all you who are overburdened, stressed out, right? And, you know, when you do that, I'll give you rest, and you go, all right, here comes sabbatical. Right? Here comes vacation. Here comes lazy boy recliner. No, here comes yoke. You know, I thought this is supposed to be good news. I don't like it. I don't. But and again, what is a yoke? Y-O-K-E, don't give me the egg answer. It's a way for oxen to join them together. Or what else is a yoke? I don't even think that's the specific. It's a harness for working that we could work. Like if you're going to carry buckets of water, you're going to have the little yoke around your neck hanging down so you can put a bucket on either side and carry two buckets of water or whatever it is you're going to carry.
It spreads out the burden.
It can spread out the burden, but the whole thing is that the yoke is too much stuff up here. Right? It's an instrument of work, and in that sense, it's a carrying device, right? It's going to help you carry something. And so, in other words, what Jesus is saying in all of this is for those of you who are overworked, overstressed, burdened from carrying life, what I will provide for you is not, again, a way out of life. I mean, you know, if you're overworked and things are tough, well, hey, die. It'll be easy. I mean, no, the sense here is, how are you going to carry life? How are you going to carry on? And so what Jesus provides for us is the yoke, is the instrument by which we can carry our own lives and everything else that's there. And he amplifies that by saying then, come, learn from me. So that Jesus' yoke, if you will, is Jesus' teaching. The teachings of Jesus are the ways which we carry our lives. And again, that works individually and for the community. So that links it up again with teaching. That links it up with feeding. This is what this slave put in charge of the household, why he is dealing with the sense of feeding. Because feeding, again, is the nurturing, sustaining, if you will, to use this metaphor, the carrying of our lives. And that's what that slave has been entrusted.
Well, if I'm thinking in terms of I am with you always, I wonder if perhaps it doesn't include that we will then have Jesus as a fellow yoke bearer seeing us through. So it will not be, we will not be alone. And think the really weary and burdened are the ones who at least are thinking they're doing it all alone, and we don't have to do it all alone because we have.
They can be the ones who are thinking they have to do it all alone. I think as well in the entire gospel as you look at this, those who are wearied and burdened are usually characterized by Jesus. What is it that wearies them and overburdens them? Put it in our language, the church. Right? Who is criticized by Jesus for overburdening people? The scribes and Pharisees, the religious authorities, to say, you know, I'll keep it in our language, church leaders, look at the burdens you are putting upon your people. Right? The indictment can there be. Pastors, why are you burdening your people? Overburdening, in many sense, right? Dumping the wrong stuff on them and making them carry that. You're supposed to feed them and supply them with my yoke, my teaching, my way of carrying their lives, which is not going to overburden them. It's a, in that sense again, as here, you know, the faithful and practically wise leader is the one that does not overburden the others within the community. And that's overburdening them usually with all of that useless stuff that we think is so extremely important. So again, the wise one, the experienced one, really knows what to tell, what is central and integral and important for the life of faith, for the sake of the gospel, over against all that stuff that's extraneous. And again, what that may or may not be is going to vary in different contexts. So what we have here, again, is the sense of the relevant application of the word. And so the teachers teach two realities, if you will, right? As a teacher, one teaches the truth of the gospel, but one also teaches people. And so the sense there now of what teaching entails, right? And that's the challenge. That's where the wisdom and faithfulness come in, is how do you teach the truth and how do you teach people? And I think here particularly, how does one teach such that you do not burden them? Because it's so easy to turn the teaching into something that does not free and liberate people, right? Deliver them because of the good news of the gospel, but it can burden them. Example, right? Where does the temptation for these kinds of things come in? For many pastors, their experience of hell in this life, confirmation class. Yeah, there's some nods out there. Been there, done that, right? What happens? Because, you know, sometimes kids that age have lots of energy, rambunctious, aren't quite at the development level to see what all this might have to do with their life or whatever. And so when that happens, as a teacher, the temptation is simply to come down hard and to come down with law. So you say, all right,
by next week, you're going to memorize the Athanasian Creed. Immediately, they pay attention. Right? Place a little burden on them, and they'll shape up. Now, again, I'm not saying you can't have discipline or anything like that, but the sense is, and that's a silly example, but isn't that what can so easily happen? That you place burdens upon people. Jesus again says in his criticism of the scribes and Pharisees, right? You place these burdens on, you know, right? All these tithes, all these proper practices, all these things they've got to do. And they're so overwhelmed with it, they really don't hear what Torah and covenant are all about. I will be your God and you will be my people, right? They have no, they can't hear that because they're so busy. Well, okay, now do I have my tenth of cumin? Do I have my tenth of pepper? Do I have my, right? And, you know, they're so burdened, they don't hear the promise. And so that's the injunction here, right? Leaders, teachers, people of God, don't so overburden folks, even with the teach. And the teaching can be good stuff, right? In and of itself, the content is great. But you've presented it, you teach it in such a way that it just simply burdens people. And then it's a yoke that's not easy and light, but it's very, very heavy, right? That it's harder to carry the yoke than the other stuff that you're supposed to be carrying. That's the dilemma. That's what's happening here in terms of saying, at least in the beginning, right, this head waitri is to feed the rest of the household. And then we shift our understanding a little bit to a beatitude. It's as though, you know, we had these beatitudes at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, and finally Jesus kind of said, "Oh yeah, hey, I've got one more beatitude," and it's expressed in the same kind of way in verse 46. Right? "Blessed is that slave whom his master will find at work when he arrives." And again, kind of, isn't that interesting that the master is to find you at work? Not in Bible study, not at prayer, not engaged in some kind of spiritual exercise, but finds you as a waitri, feeding, nourishing, teaching the household of God. It seems in this parable and also in the one that follows about the bridesmaids, if we try to think about this in terms of Matthew's community, as I said earlier this week, we get a sense of Matthew's community here that he has some difficulty with the notion of authority that's at work in the community, because the authority seems to be some sense of hierarchy and suggested perhaps historically, right? Matthew writing to the community at Antioch with Ignatius there, the development of the bishop is the authority, and things go down from that in kind of classic pyramid fashion. And of course, if that's the case, that is also the kind of pyramid structure, the top-down structure, that's also the kind of structure where burdens can be opposed, right? Things can get kind of heavy if you happen to find yourself at the base of the pyramid, right, in terms of all of that. So Matthew questions some of that ways of being authority in his community. And again, we see that coming through here. It seems, secondly, that within Matthew's community, now I'll just characterize it this way, that it seems to be comprised of some very charismatic spiritual folk, a kind of suggestion of people that we might also have that Paul tries to address in his first letter to the Corinthians. Right. The folks that, in my folksy way, are the ones who present themselves as the spiritual giants, the spiritual warriors in the community. And Matthew seems to be extremely critical of them. And that what he understands the community to be comprised of, and in some senses say, watch out for those charismatic spiritual warrior giant types, or, you know, the kind of hyper-apostles that Paul uses that term in 2 Corinthians. You know, watch out for those who claim to be too filled with the Spirit. Because those who are too filled with the Spirit are usually just simply too full of themselves. Right? And that seems to be part of Matthew's criticism here. And so, again, he always looks at the notion of who is the person within the community. They are the slave. They are the worker. They are the ones who hear and do the will of God. And again, hearing and doing the will of God for Matthew is not equated with this kind of charismatic spiritual way of life. It's, again, feeding the household, teaching, caring for the least. And so there again, I think, if one tries to read Matthew carefully and ask the question, what community is he trying to address? It's a community that is having some problems and conflicts with regard to authority in the church, and problems and conflicts with regard to, you know, what is the life of a follower of Jesus to be all about. And so we have that sense. Verse 48. Right. We change now from that kind of faithful. If you're not faithful, what's the other possibility? You could be wicked. And so if that wicked slave might say in his heart, my master won't be coming for a long time yet, then what happens? Right. And so we have the sense here that to believe in the absence of the master is to move away from the master, or to make a connection. To believe in the absence of Christ is to move away from Christ. It's a sense, if you will, of hopelessness. Only it's not simply expressed in the usual way we would talk about hopelessness. But it's hopeless. I have no hope that my master is returning, and so therefore, in the absence of the master, what will I do? I'll become the master. And that has disastrous consequences. Verse 49. Right. This person begins to beat his fellow slaves, eats and drinks with drunkards. those of a party spirit. Well, again, culturally speaking, the life of partying and beating up others was always the prerogative of the master. That's what you get to do, right? If I'm the master, I get to throw the parties, and you get to be the slaves and serve all the guests that I invite, and if you don't do a good job, I get to slap you around a little bit. Hey, that's fun, right? That's the role. And so we see here what happens now is all of a sudden the head waitress says the master won't show up. Right? The directors will never come back into the village, so I'm taken over. And again, it's taking over in a way that is violent and brutal. And think about that in terms of often when one has no hope, the consequence of that is some kind of violent action. You can think about that at first, again, in a kind of silly example, right? You're there working away at your computer and all of a sudden, and it's dead. And it's, so you get out the manual, you do all the things, well, try this, try that, and it doesn't work. Quentin's not around to help you, so you're left on your own, right? There's no hope because the media ministry genius is gone. It's his day off. So you're trying to fix it yourself. And you're there, but all of a sudden, it's hopeless. And so when you're hopeless in front of your computer, what do you do? Maybe three good whacks on the side will make it work. Right? Hopelessness leads to violence. Simple little example. We all do that, right? Think about that, right? The stupid computer. Give it a whack. More seriously, in our world today, terrorism. Doesn't terrorism spring from hopelessness? When you think there is no hope in your situation, that no matter what you do, what you say, what you try, there is no one coming to deliver or transform or change, you will simply strike out. Because after all, you've got nothing to lose, and you might gain some power, some control, get someone's attention. Because after all, terrorists have gotten our attention. Unfortunately, we haven't responded very well. I think, unfortunately, we've basically responded as though the situation is hopeless as well. So we've struck out with violence. And it's disastrous. Getting us nowhere. And so here the sense is people of God, community of faith, if you think things are hopeless, if Jesus is absent, is not around, what's the temptation? To strike out violently, abusively, ways that enforce control, but are always improper and are contrary to the way of the gospel. That's the wicked servant. That's their, that sense of the loss of hope.
What gives hope is the presence of God, the presence of Christ in our world, in our life, and having a God so that you're not it,
to the misuse of authority and then the misuse of role, and in Matthew's sense, also that of wealth. I mean, the slave was in charge of all of his possessions. Mm-hmm. So he had that resource at his fingertips also. And I remember being pointed out in Matthew 10 when the disciples are sent out. In Matthew, Jesus says, take no copper or silver or gold.
Right.
And Mark says, take no copper. Luke says, take no copper or silver. Matthew says, take no copper, silver, or gold. So the community may have been one of wealth and great resource also. And that to be then misused with authority.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing, given the fact, as you have said in all your lectures, that we're looking at this with the end in mind. The end is go therefore to make disciples, teaching them. So if it is sort of a working manual for the church, then what this seems to say to me is that when you're on mission, when you're on task in a way that fulfills that call, then you're given the resources to deal with it. And I have to say in my experience that when I see congregations who really are on mission, when they're on the tasks that God is calling us to do, then the resources just tumble out of the sky almost, they're always available to the community for their use.
They've always already been there within the community, right? Mm-hmm. Assets-based community development. Jody Kretzman, sitting back there, will tell you all about that.
And
but
then
you're right.
The opposite is also true, which would be the model of the wicked servant, that when you get so focused on yourself and your squabbles and your, all of your, you get chaotic, then the resources just seem to dry up.
Because you're trying to marshal resources about how faction A can beat faction B and bring faction C onto their side.
Right. Yeah. And then what happens, I think, is then the master shows up. I mean, the mission is there for that community. It never goes away. So the master shows up, but they don't see it. They're so focused on their problems and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Any other thoughts on this parable so far? Upstairs is very quiet. The upper. Yeah.
It's real commonly applied to the individual believer, as well as, I mean, to me it's new to even mention the bishop. Thank you for doing that. But don't we need to also be taking this as an injunction for the way we behave and the way we treat each other just in our little communities?
Certainly. Certainly. Yeah, I mean, this, I mentioned bishop not to pick on, but I mean, to organize a church in terms of bishops and all of that, that's fine. I mean, you can be much more flat in ways of organization, and it can also be an abuse of authority. I mean, the issue here is just simply, like I said, I think Matthew's community has an issue with the kind of top-down authority, and that's what's happening here. So that, again, just to kind of summarize some of this in terms of a notion of authority. From this parable, it seems that when we're talking about authority, four things you may want to say. First of all, it's derivative. Right? I don't have authority on my own. That has been, right? It was the master who set this servant over the household. It's derivative. Secondly, it's temporary. Right? It's not like master says, okay, you're it forever. Third, it is for the good of others. Right? The key question there in all notions of authority and when you act authoritatively, you should always ask yourself the question, for whose good? And if the answer to that is for my good, then it's probably an abusive exercise of authority, right? Because it's for the good of others. And that leads me to the fourth point, that a leader within the community is a servant to the servants. Again, we often talk about that notion of servant leadership. But again, there's the sense of one is the servant to the servants.
What was the first one?
Derivative. All right, so with that, I erased it. Let's go.
You can't get it back.
Let's go back to that question. I'll ask it in the second way. Is it not judgment which makes grace grace? As we look at this parable here, and now we've made this judgment about this servant placed in authority who's really not a good servant at all, is finally not wise, prudent, faithful. Then to ask the question, where's the grace in this parable? How does this parable of judgment help us get a better understanding of grace?
One of the, I think you mentioned confirmation earlier, you know, whenever I teach the Ten Commandments in confirmation, you teach them not as things you're not supposed to do, but as possibilities for the enrichment of your life. In other words, God, this is God's way. He's the one who made the world, and he knows what's best for the human beings that he made in it. Then listen to this, because if you focus on him, you're going to be happy. You know, if you don't trash your relationships, you're going to have a meaningful life. It's going to be purposeful. So it's not really judgment, it's really grace, but the judgment comes in the fact that we just are incapable of focusing on the grace. So there's an implied judgment, I guess is what he's saying. So what I see this parable doing is just drawing us back to that understanding that, you know, if you keep your focus on God's purpose and his way, your life will be meaningful and you'll be happy. And you'll find joy. When you depart from that the judgment happens. And so in that sense, yes, judgment does grace.
So it serves as a warning.
Yeah, it serves as a warning, but a warning still isn't grace, right? I mean, how are we going to get to grace? Let me talk about the Ten Commandments there for that just brought something up. The wonderful thing about Hebrew, also very frustrating, is that it only gives you the consonants and the vowel pointings are added later. And when you read the consonants in the Ten Commandments, the verbs, I mean, you can point that in such a way that it says, thou shalt not kill. And that's the way we do it, and that's fine. But you can also point that in such a way that those become future, so that you can read that commandment, all those commandments as, there will come a time when there will be no killing.
Oh.
You like that. I like that too. The thing is, that time when there will be no killing is not a time that I can bring about. And that's why I have to read that, thou shalt not kill, because, you know, at times I'd like to kill people, right? Or whatever, right? Or as Jesus ups the ante on that, just simply hate someone else or say to somebody, you fool. Right. But there will come a time when that will no longer happen. You go, oh, well, that must be the end of the world. Yeah, it is, isn't it? But that is that time when what? When Christ's presence is fully at work among us, such that we have the grace that there will be no more killing. I think that's, now I'm answering my own question. I think that's how grace works its way into it. And again, without the judgment, without the law, you would not be able to see how essential, how absolutely foundational grace is to carrying out this way of life. And so here again, back to the teaching, back to the burdening, right? You can feed the people in such a way that you basically beat them up with your teaching, right? Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt memorize the Athanasian Creed. Thou shalt, right? Whatever it is you're going to do. That's not going to help anyone see grace, see the presence of Christ. But you can use judgment, yet in such a way that grace will become apparent. Rick?
One of the major movements in organizational theory, secular organizational theory, is visionary leadership, values of visionary leadership, because the command and control model that dominated organizational life coming out of the First and Second World War models end up with the kind of problems that you're talking about that a judgment-based approach has. I spent a lot of time with leaders of those who want to try to move away from the command and control model, and the part that's so interesting is that I was talking to a woman at breakfast today who said the same exact thing. When the further up you go in management, when you try to work in that way, the more burdened you actually feel. She was saying, when I was a nurse, I had my patients, I took care of whatever. But when I got into management, then I really felt the burden. And part of the problem there is to be a teacher in the way you're talking about is a lot more, it is a lot more complicated because it means having to let go of illusions about control. I like that quote about the verse 10, whatever it was, about be like Jesus, where Jesus is like humble and gentle in carrying his yoke. Mm-hmm. But to go to that place when you have all this responsibility, right, for teaching and leading, and be gentle and humble, it sounds like this easy thing to do, but I spend a lot of time with people who really struggle because it means saying, I'm willing to give up the illusion of control that judgment and rules, provides for me. That's a hard thing for people to let go of. It really is. It's really difficult.
I think it's hard for the followers to let go of, too. Right. I think that's part of the problem that we have, is that it's much simpler, especially in a complex world with all the issues, to look for the easy answer and to have someone tell you, okay, this is the answer and here are the rules. And then you just say, okay, I'll just follow these rules and I'll be okay. And it's, for all of us, isn't it easier just to have the rules laid out? And even though when we sit around and talk about this and read this, the rules are kind of laid out and they're not really rules, but it's more, you have to think a lot more and you have to be in the moment and just...
gentle and humble.
Yeah, and so for the leaders and for the followers, it takes more effort, and maybe that's kind of where the grace comes too, is that you don't have to do it all by yourself, if you keep remembering that. But I think it's difficult.
Well, I think to add to that is hopefulness, that yes, we're trying this, it didn't happen today, but we've got tomorrow, so we'll try it again. Maybe.
Yes, over there, please.
Well, I guess I put this in terms of responsibility, and when the slave is left responsible and is still working at Christ's return, everything's fine. But it doesn't say things have gotten better. I mean, sometimes we decide about what our goal is, and then we, you know, that's when the control and the over authority of the fullness of maybe comes to be. And so that the burden then isn't ours, but it needs to be us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, again, in terms of teaching, I think about that because, you know, the sense of teaching with love, teaching with hope. If any of you have read Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed and the banking model of education, it's hopeless. I mean, think about this. I mean, think of what I go through before we're in here at 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, the night before I'm working on this, and you know, it's going through my mind, and I'll come in here and I'll sit down, and I look at you and I go, oh, you know. I'm the expert. I studied this stuff. I got my Greek New Testament here. And, you know, there's all these stupid people. and they don't know anything.
And we're going to leave stupid.
And and you don't pay attention. You won't listen. You don't give me the respect I deserve.
We'll memorize it's really, the Greek for
you. It's really hopeless. But, you know, the task is, what I do is give you the brain dump, and it's all in your empty receptacles, and now that you've got that, and then we'll have an examination, which, what, you projectile vomit everything back to me again. And if you can tell me exactly what I have told you, we call that education. Right? I mean, that's a little, actually, Freire's pretty close to saying that, and that happens so often in the classroom, and why wouldn't it be any different in Bible study or whatnot? But the thing is, basically, I think one of the key presuppositions that go in there is the whole teaching enterprise is hopeless. So right away, you come up with a controlling, dominating authority model. Precisely what is not supposed to happen in terms of this parable.
Right. Well, many of us have had a wonderful experience and can relate this to when we were young and had our children, we attempted to use this method. And I'm not talking just about one family, but I'm going to say I've observed this in many, many families where along would come a child who just wasn't going to take it. And the parents were up against either the battle of the ages or they had to find another way. And so some people at the level of parents of their own children find it. But even the ones who struggle through that and their kids somehow survive and they just get it done and get out of the house and leave me alone for a while, when they're grandparents, they have a whole other model. And they treat their grandchildren very differently than they treated their original set of children. I see this over and over again. Slow learners.
Anything? Yes, please.
I'm thinking of a good example in the pastor's children's sermon. So often, you know, you present the scenario to this bunch of little kids, and they're listening intently, and then they come up with something totally off the wall that maybe sort of applies, but in their mind it does. And so you have no control over what they're going to receive. You share, and sometimes we learn more from their comments, those of us in the congregation. It can be very surprising.
I'm back to the text, the recurring question on these parables and the summer theme and things like that. When you just said in the Ten Commandments, there will come a time when there will be no killing, I'm wondering how the Greek really translates, like the last thing, even unto the end of the world, you have said the consummation of creation. Of the ages. And of all these times when they say the Lord cometh, one time you wrote arrived, is there some room in this language not to have the end of the world be, Jesus reappears and there's an apocalyptic event and there's the end of the world? And are there some, when you say the consummation of
the ages, those kind of things. Is there some room here for some metaphor and other understanding rather than kind of the traditional, you know, it's going to blow up or we're going to go to heaven or there's going to be a rapture or, you know, whatever?
Yeah, I mean, there again, I mean, and we, that was last week in the sense of the beginning of chapter 24. All the bad stuff has happened, and we get the word there, but that's not the beginning, that's not the end. The whole sense of the end here is indeed talking about the parousia, the presence, the coming of Christ, and part of that, again, as we ended up yesterday with, you know, be the ready ones, the sense is that coming is always coming, right? That sense of adventing, that Christ is always coming toward us and is present with us, but that is and is not the end at the same time. There's always that tension that's there, but we are as ready ones living as if it is the end. I think that's the kind of message Matthew wants us to see.
There's a certain sense in which you know, in the way you've been describing this, that when we encounter the risen Christ in the present, it is the end. That's why Jesus said, let's pray, thy kingdom come, because the kingdom comes in that moment, in that present time, when Christ's fulfillment reaches the heart of whoever it needs to reach. It could be while somebody's proclaiming or teaching that somebody gets it. Well, then the end has happened, you see, because they get it. And so in that sense, it really is the fulfillment of time. But then there's always more.
Okay. So, do you get it?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, then it's the end. Thank you. We'll pick it up tomorrow.